This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose, and this morning I decided to read to you about mosses, which are technically not flowers. They do not have petals, but I thought they belonged, and I do like the book that I'll be using called Gathering Moss by Robin Wall Kimmerer. And regarding mosses as not being flora, the word moss is commonly applied to plants which are not actually mosses. Reindeer moss is a lichen. Spanish moss is a flowering plant. Sea moss is an alga. And club moss is a lycophyte. So what is a moss? A true moss, or bryophyte, is the most primitive of land plants. Mosses are often described by what they lack in comparison to the more familiar higher plants. They lack flowers, fruits, and seeds, have no roots, they have no vascular system, no xylem, no phloem to conduct water. They are the most simple of plants, and in their simplicity, elegant. With just a few rudimentary components of stem and leaf, evolution has produced some 22,000 species of moss worldwide. Each one is a variation on a theme, a unique creation designed for success in tiny niches in virtually every ecosystem. Robin Wall Kimmerer begins her book with the chapter, The Standing Stones. Barefoot, I've walked this path by night for nearly 20 years, most of my life, it seems, the earth pressing up against the arch of my foot. More often than not, I leave my flashlight behind to let the path carry me home. My feet touching the ground are like fingers on the piano, playing from memory with an old sweet song of pine needles and sand. Without thinking, I notice step down carefully over the big root, the one by the big sugar maple, where garter snakes bask every morning. I whacked my toe there once, so I remember. At the bottom of the hill, where rain washes out the path, I detour into ferns for a few steps, avoiding sharp gravel. The path rises over a ridge of smooth granite where I can feel the day's warmth still lingering in the rock. The rest is easy. Sand and grass. Past the place where my daughter Larkin stepped into a nest of yellowjacks when she was six. Past the thicket of stripped maple where we once found a whole family of baby screech owls lined up on a branch, sound asleep. I turn off toward my cabin, just at the spot where I can hear the spring dripping, smell its dampness, and feel its moisture rising up between my toes. I first came here as a student to fulfill my undergraduate requirement for field biology at Cranberry Lake Biological Station. This is where I was first introduced to mosses, following Dr. Kettledge through the woods, discovering mosses with the aid of the standard issue hand lens, the Ward Scientific student model borrowed from the stockroom that I wore around my neck on a dirty string. I knew I was committed when at the end of the class I spent part of my sparse college savings to send off for a professional grade Bausch & Lomb lens like his. I still have that lens and wear it on a red cord as I take my students along the trails at Cranberry Lake, where I return to join the faculty and to eventually become the biostation director. In all those years, the mosses haven't changed nearly as much as I have. That patch that Ket showed us along the Tower Trail is still there. Each summer, I stop for a closer look and wonder at its longevity. These past few summers, I've been conducting research on rocks, trying to learn what I can about how communities form by observing the way moss species gather together on boulders. Each boulder stands apart like a desert island in a swelling sea of forest. Its only inhabitants are mosses. We're trying to figure out why one rock, 10 or more species of moss, may comfortably coexist, while a nearby, outwardly the same, rock is dominated by just a single moss living alone. What are the conditions that foster diverse communities rather than isolated individuals? The question is very complex for mosses, let alone for humans. By summer's end, we should have a tidy little publication, our scholarly contribution to the truth about rocks and mosses. Glacial boulders are scattered over the Adirondacks, the round tumbled granite left behind by ice 10,000 years ago. Their mossy bulk makes forests seem primeval, yet I know how much the scenery has changed around them from the day they were stranded in a barren plain of glacial outwash to thick maple woods that surround them today. Most of the boulders reach only to my shoulders, but for some we need a ladder to survey them completely. My students and I wrap measuring tape around their girth. We record light and pH, collect data on the number of crevices and the depth and thin skin of humus. We carefully catalog the positions of all the moss species, calling out their names. Struggling to record all this begs for shorter names. But mosses don't have only scientific names conferred with legalistic formality according to protocol. A good number of rocks around here have names, and people use them for reference points around the lake. Chair rock, gull rock, burnt rock, elephant rock, sliding rock. Each name calls up a story and connects us to the past and present of this place every time we say it. My daughters have been raised in a place where they simply assume that all rocks have names, christened their own. Bread rock, cheese rock, whale rock, reading rock, diving rock. The names we use for rocks and other beings depends on our perspective, whether we are speaking from the inside or the outside of the circle. The name on our lips reveals the knowledge we have of each other, hence the sweet secret names we have for the ones we love. The names we give ourselves are a powerful form of self-determination, of declaring ourselves sovereign territory. Outside the circle, scientific names for mosses may suffice, but within the circle, what do they call themselves? One of the charms of the biostation is that it doesn't change much from summer to summer. We can put it on each June like a faded flannel shirt, still smelling of last summer's wood smoke. It's the bedrock of our lives, our true home, a constant amidst other changes. There hasn't been a summer when pergolas don't nest in the spruces by the dining hall. In mid-July, before the blueberries ripen, a bear will regularly wander through camp, hungry. Beavers swim like clockwork past the front dock 20 minutes after sunset, and the morning mist always hangs longest in the south call on Bear Mountain. Oh, sometimes things change. On a hard winter, the ice might shift the driftwood on the shore. Once a silvery old log, the one with a branch like a heron's neck, got moved 60 feet down the bay. And one summer, the sapsuckers ended up nesting in a different tree after the top blew out of the rotten old aspen in a gale. On the sand, the way the lake can go from flat calm to 3-foot rollers, the way aspen leaves sound hours before a rain, the way the texture of evening clouds foretells the next day's winds. I find strength and comfort in this physical intimacy with the land, a sense of knowing the names of the rocks, knowing my place in the world. On this wild shore, my internal landscape is a near-perfect reflection of the external world. So I was stunned by what I saw today on what had always been a familiar trail. A few miles down the shore from my cabin, it stopped me in my tracks. Disoriented, I caught my breath, glancing all around to reassure myself I was still on the same trail and hadn't wandered into some twilight zone where things are not as they seem. I've walked this path more times than I can tell, and yet it was only today that I was able to see them. 5 stones, each the size of a school bus, lying together in a pile, their curves fitting together like an old married couple secure in each other's arms. The glacier must have pushed them into this loving conformation and moved on. I circle around the pile in silence, brushing my fingertips over its mosses. On the east side, there is an opening, a cave-like darkness between the rocks. Somehow, I knew it would be there. The door, which I have never seen before, looks strangely familiar. My family comes from the Bear clan of the Potawatomi. Bear is a holder of medicine knowledge, for the people has a special relationship with plants. He is the one who calls them by name and knows their stories. We seek him for a vision. We find the task we were meant for. I think I am following a bear. The landscape itself seems alert, with every detail in unnaturally sharp focus. I stand in an island of surreal quiet, where time feels weighty on the rocks, and yet when I shake my head, clearing my vision, I can hear the familiar whoosh of waves on the shore, and the red starts chittering over my head. The cave draws me inward, on my hands and knees, into the dark, beneath tons of rock. Imagining the den of a bear, I creep ahead, the rock rough against my bare arms. Around a turn, the light from the outside disappears behind me. I breathe in the coolness, and there is no scent of bear, just soft ground and the smell of granite. I don't know how long I was gone, minutes or hours. For that interval, I had no sensation of my own existence. There was only rock and moss and rock. Like a hand laid gently on my shoulder, I come back to myself and look around. The trance is broken. I can hear red starts again calling overhead. The encircling walls are radiant with mosses of every kind. I see them again as if for the first time, the green and the gray, old and new. In this place and this time, they rest together for the moment between glaciers. My ancestors knew that rocks hold Earth's stories, and for a moment I could hear them. My thoughts feel noisy here, an annoying buzz disrupting the slow conversation among the stones. The door on the wall has reappeared, and time starts to move again. An opening into the circle of stones was made, and a gift given. I can see things differently from the inside of the circle as well as from the outside. A gift comes with responsibility. I had no will at all to name the mosses in this place, to assign their Linnaean epithets. I think the task given to me is to carry out the message that mosses have their own names. Their way of being in the world cannot be told by data alone. They remind me to remember there are mysteries for which a measuring tape has no meaning. Questions and answers have no place in the truth about rocks and mosses. The tunnel seems easier on the way out. This time I know where I am going. I look back over my shoulder at the stones and then set my feet to the familiar path for home. I know I am following a bear. This is Helen Cannon. Thank you for listening.